Rob Picciolo, who was a major league infielder with the A's, Brewers, and Angels from 1977 through 1985, and then a coach for many years after, often in the major leagues, passed away this week at the age of 64, and I truly regret that. I didn't know him, unfortunately, but he sounds like he was a wonderful guy. The list of encomiums from former associates has been lengthy, and I very much like this one from Padres broadcaster Ted Leitner, who said, "So shocked, so sad, at the passing of longtime Padres coach Rob Picciolo. Baseball has never had a nicer man as player or coach. If you get to heaven and Rob's not there, trust me, you're not in heaven." Picciolo is a great example. Ted Williams is another in a very different way, that players on field skills often don't have anything to do with their off-field skills, by which I mean Williams was the greatest hitter of all time, but as a manager, he tended to alienate people and didn't always teach very well. And conversely, Picciolo was about as far from Ted Williams as a hitter as you can be. In fact, he specifically rejected one aspect of Williams' game, patience. But he was a beloved coach. Rejected is a loaded term. I'll get back to that in a second. It's not to say that Picciolo, who came out of Pepperdine University, was untalented. He must have been. The scouts must have seen things in him because he was drafted repeatedly. Never in the June draft. There used to be all these other phases, the January phase of the draft and the June secondary phase of the draft. And he went and high up about five times in these different drafts before signing with the A's. The A's, as a virtually bankrupt organization that was rushing all kinds of players to the bigs at that time, rushed him to the majors before, or possibly after, he had come to grips with the strike zone, by which I mean he just decided that he didn't need it. And again, decided is a tough term, and it seems like there are some players who have good pitch recognition and make a virtue of patience, and others that have poor pitch recognition and can't even if they wanted to. They just do not have a good perceptual ability when it comes to knowing whether the pitch is going to end up in or out of the strike zone. That said, there's usually enough variance, even among the most impatient guys. They might walk 25 times a year, 30 times a year. It does happen. It's very rare that a guy walks never. In 1984, the shortstop Alfredo Griffin with the Blue Jays walked about four times in around 450 plate appearances. And that was a choice. I really believe it was a choice because there were many other seasons where, again, he was never Frank Thomas. But he walked more than that. It seems to me that you've just made a decision at that point that you are, as often as possible, unless the pitcher really just gives you four balls that are a yard outside, you are swinging. Picciolo was that kind of guy. I first noticed him that same year in 1984. He was coming off the bench for the Angels. He played in 87 games, and he walked a grand total of no times. It was only 128 plate appearances, but he just never drew a walk. He hit .202. His on-base percentage was lower than his batting average at .200, and because he didn't have much power either, he slugged .277. Picciolo's campaign wasn't wholly unique. Given a like number of plate appearances, it's been done 10 times in baseball history, but most of them, in fact 7 of the 10, were compiled well before 1920. The two more recent examples underscore what I mean about choice. In 1973, the Phillies had a rookie named Craig Robinson who got 148 plate appearances and didn't walk at all. They immediately traded him to the Braves, and the next season, incredibly enough, the Braves made him their starting shortstop, and in 506 plate appearances, he drew 30 walks. In 1985, the year after Picciolo went walkless, the Tiger used outfielder Alejandro Sanchez for 71 games and 133 plate appearances. Sanchez had power, but because he walked zero times, he finished with the very strange triple slash line, 248, 248, 459. He drew one walk a year later, and despite appearing in six different seasons for a total of 215 plate appearances, that was the only walk he ever drew. Now, even in the minors, where he had a much more extensive career, he was hardly Ed Yost, but he did walk 20, 25 times a year, so You wonder if something beyond skill was going on there, and that's why I talk about choice. As you might imagine, Picciolo's chronic impatience and general lack of ability to hit held back his career somewhat. He only played one full season as a starter. That was in his rookie year of 1977. He played 148 games, had 446 plate appearances, and walked 9 times. He did this with a batting average of 200 and an on-base percentage of .218. He hit 2 home runs for a slugging percentage of .218. And it seems like after that, he decided that he had just been too passive, that those 9 walks represented a failing of some kind, because he was even more aggressive after that. For a major league career that lasted 9 seasons, he had 731 games and 1,720 plate appearances, and he walked a total of 25 times. To put that in perspective, Aaron Judge walked 30 times this June alone. And just to be really clear about this, I'm not using the opportunity of the man's passing to criticize him. His skills were his skills, and no doubt he did the best that he could with what he was given. That's not my point. My point is that in this one way, he was perhaps the most limited player in baseball history. No player, given a like amount of playing time, has walked so rarely. Just to give you one more example in that regard, using a current player, Alcides Escobar, who has been with the Royals as their starting shortstop going back to 2011, is on the short list of regulars who have been the most impatient players of all time. Escobar has played almost 1,300 games and has drawn 202 walks, yet even he, on a 162-game basis, draws about 25 walks a year. If you look at the ratio section on Baseball Reference, you'll note that as impatient as Escobar is, he walks in about 4% of his plate appearances. Picciolo walked in 1.5. The thing I've noticed about baseball, though, as an institution, is that it's basically sentimental. And if you're a good person, the game will take care of you. The players who are jerks and who seem to have personality problems when they're playing, they don't get to hang around after they retire. Never mind retirement, they're an endangered species from the moment their skills start to slip, because if you can't play well, and you're not good company, what reason is there to keep you around? Whereas Picciolo never really manifested any skills at all, but he got to stay around forever. And maybe they don't want to. In this day and age, they take their $1 million and they buy a private island, and they're gone. And they're happy about that. But a lot more of them, I think, enjoy the camaraderie, they enjoy being part of the scene, they want to hold on to that part of their youth that was so special to them. So if you are a good person, if you can teach, if you can just do something positive. And in one of the articles I saw about Picciolo's passing, Trevor Hoffman talks about how after games, Picciolo would give his kids ice cream. And you know, that warms my heart more than knowing he was good at waving runners in from third base or hitting fungos during batting practice or that he had a great batting eye and that when he was 25, he was capable of drawing 110 free passes a year. The legacy is not the back of the baseball card, but who you were. And to mangle the Beatles, in the end, the love you make is not equal to the walks you take. It's in the lives that you affect in a positive way. There is one really curious incident in Rob Picciolo's career. He was intentionally walked once. Some manager decided to do for him what he could not do for himself. And I was curious what manager that was. Well, the game in question occurred on September 8th, 1979. White Sox at A's. Picciolo was with the A's. He started and batted 9th that day while playing shortstop. The game was tied 1-1 going to the bottom of the 9th. A pitcher named Mike Proley was on the mound for the White Sox, facing the 7, 8, and 9 hitters in the A's batting order. Here is how the inning went. A's first baseman Jeff Newman led off, hit a ball to third. White Sox third baseman Kevin Bell threw it away, allowing Newman to reach. It's ironic that Buck Weaver, the White Sox third baseman in 1919, was about the only innocent guy in the whole Black Sox story, because in most tales of White Sox failure, the third baseman is almost always the culprit. It's about as much of a cliche as the butler did it. The A's pinch ran for Newman. That brought up Wayne Gross, who I mentioned on this show just last week. Gross singles to right field, chasing the runner to third. Now it's first and third. No outs. What is the White Sox manager to do with Rob Picciolo? Well, apparently he was trembling in fear of the idea that Rob Picciolo would hit a sacrifice fly. So he decided to intentionally walk him to load the bases with no outs, create a play at the plate, somehow get a double play on the next batter, get out of it somehow. The problem with this theory was that the next batter, and for that matter the manager, would know each other well in the future. The batter that was brought to the plate by intentionally walking Rod Piccolo was Ricky Henderson. By odd coincidence, one of Ricky's main skills was the one thing that Piccolo couldn't do, which was take ball four. Ricky walked over 2,000 times in his career, and one of the earliest of those many walks came in this game off of Mike Proley in the bottom of the ninth with the bases loaded. The pinch runner scored, the A's walked off with a win, and none of it mattered because neither of these teams was going anywhere in 1979, but the White Sox manager was. He was going to the Hall of Fame. His name was Tony La Russa. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. How do you like life in the igloo? Yes, this episode is coming to you from under a Sherpa blanket. I'd like you better if you were a glass dolphin, she says. And in your eagerness to please her, you miss the word like, not love. But you love her, so although you've always been happy with your form, you schedule the surgery that will reduce your mass by 98% and transform you into a small, inert blue keepsake. You are returned to her in a small white box, and you are alarmed when she places you in a drawer and forgets about you for 6 months. There in the darkness, you can discern other small blue keepsakes, glass giraffes, glass hippos, glassfish, which seems rather redundant. Her moods have always been mercurial, and you believe, really believe, that one day she will open the drawer and remember you. Indeed, she does reopen the drawer, but only to withdraw the glass hippo and smash it with a hammer. And it is only then that you understand the extent to which being in a relationship with someone who does not love you for who you are can be a shattering experience. Be proud of who you are and listen to episode 36. What is it with you that you're only attracted to people who want to turn you into glass dolphins anyway? Welcome back to the show. This week I'm rejoined by Jesse Spector in his usual spot. I've screwed up the rotation. It looks a lot like one of Casey Stengel's in the 50s, where outside of Whitey Ford, you can't really tell who's in the rotation and who's in the bullpen. Some of that is no doubt on account of the holidays and the fact that we did a couple of shortened episodes. Guest-free wasn't intentional because I love having Jesse here, and it was good to have him back. We talked about current events in baseball, such as they are, including quite a bit about remaining free agents, the Yankees, Marlins, Cubs, Cardinals, and so on. I hope you enjoy it. A moment of silence while I pause to read some Orioles trade rumors and scoff at the idea that the Orioles are serious about anything at all. Trade Manny Machado or don't. Start Chance Cisco at catcher or don't. Make Austin Hayes a regular in the outfield or don't. The Orioles aren't serious. This is a team that allowed 5.2 runs per 9 innings last year in a league that allowed 4.7. That is, by definition, not serious. It is, barring revolutionary and unlikely change, pretty much locked out of competing for the foreseeable future. The nature of covering baseball is that you've got to talk about every team seriously and how they might add this player or that player, but with a team like the Orioles, it is almost certainly of no consequence whatsoever. It could turn out they're sitting on some kind of drug that they can administer to Cal Ripken Jr. and restore him to his early 1980s form, and even that wouldn't change a thing. Hell, how many World Series did Cal Ripken Jr. win? By my math, one? Long time ago. Anyway, that wasn't what I wanted to talk about. As you'll hear Jesse and I discuss, this episode was recorded moments after yet another bellicose tweet from our bellicose tweeter-in-chief. And no, the episode is not about that. We touch on it just a bit. But, and this is a theme that I've hit before here, it's worth remembering what war is like, particularly in the context of a baseball podcast. I'm talking specifically about total war, not the little wars of choice that we've grown accustomed to in this country over the last, oh, now 50 years, really. It's been long enough for Ken Burns to be making epic miniseries about these things. Wars that are fought with a volunteer army and that don't impinge on the rest of our daily lives. And that feels wrong, too, because volunteer or not, small optional conflicts or not, these are our fellow citizens who are putting their lives on the line for our safety or for something. That's part of the problem. In a larger war such as that might take place on, say, the Korean Peninsula, it's not out of the question that conscription might be reinstated. And that tends to change lives, and it tends to change baseball. The 1917 and 1918 seasons were deeply affected by the fact that ballplayers were given a work or fight order. World War II, of course, many players, including stars like Joe DiMaggio, Hank Greenberg, Ted Williams, disappeared into the service for much of the conflict. And paraphrasing Bill James somewhat, the major leagues were comprised of guys who were either 16 or 45, or were missing an arm, or had 26 dependents. It was still baseball. It's all still baseball, but it wasn't the kind of baseball that anybody wanted. They wanted Williams and Greenberg and DiMaggio. And that's the minor part of it, of course. When you go to war, some people don't come back, and even those who do come back experience very severe disruption. To give you just a personal example, my maternal grandfather had a child that he never met. He paused mid-war to help create that child, then went off to battle for about 3 years, and it was only then that he was introduced to his first child. That can alter everybody's lives, the kids and the parents. And it occurred to me, as I was looking for anniversaries that were worth noting in this podcast, that this is the 75th anniversary of 1943, and at the tail end of the year, at the tail end of last year, we passed the 75th anniversary of Red Ruffing getting his draft notice. Red Ruffing, as you probably know, named Charles, Hall of Fame pitcher, had a truly strange career, started with the Red Sox when the Red Sox were about as bad as they ever were, and was a miserable pitcher. And there are a lot of theories as to why, whether it was lack of defensive support, whether he was disgruntled and trying to pitch his way out of town, whether he just hadn't figured everything out yet. We'll never know exactly. But after going 10-25 and 9-22 in consecutive seasons, he got swapped over to the Yankees in 1930. And not immediately, this goes to the learning things and just maturing slowly. He was, after all, only 25 at the time of the trade. His records turned around, although he wasn't necessarily a dramatically better pitcher. He was just a league average guy for a couple of years. It was the better defensive and run support of the Yankees that suddenly made him win games. And he only achieved real year-in, year-out consistency later as he hit his 30s, and he won 20 games in four consecutive seasons from 1936 through 1940. And as you always have to mention with Red Ruffing, he was one of the greatest hitting pitchers of all time and would occasionally spot as a pinch hitter. In fact, his career batting average as a pinch hitter was .283, which misses the top 100 for players who had 100 or more career pinch hit plate appearances by .001. So he was a better hitter, at least by that standard, and it was a high offense era, but whatever, he was still a pitcher, than many position players who have had that role. In 1942, he was 37 years old. He had some injuries, which limited him to only 24 starts, but nonetheless, he was very good, had a 3.21 ERA and 193.2 innings, which is better than league average, not hugely, but better. Went 14-7, pitched two games in the World Series, including a complete game loss in the final game. That's on the manager, not him. The game was tied 2-2 in the top of the ninth. He gave up a two-run homer. The Yankees were shut down in the bottom of the inning, end of World Series. And of course, today, he almost certainly wouldn't have been there. Joe McCarthy, great manager for a team, great manager for a clubhouse, not so great a manager on in-game stuff, but you can say that about a lot of them. Anyway, Charlie goes home when he's called before his draft board, and he's certified able to serve. There's a bunch of things wrong with that. One, again, at 37, he's on the high side of the aging curve. Two, he's missing four toes on one foot from a childhood mining accident. He was old enough that he had been born in a period of time when not only was child labor in such situations still common, but the Supreme Court had ruled that Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce did not extend so far that it allowed it to create incentives for states to not send children into mines and factories and smelters and things like that. Finally, he had multiple dependents. But the countervailing argument was that he was a successful athlete, that he had just pitched in the World Series. Clearly, if he was capable of doing those things, he was capable of fighting fascism. Now, that's not true. As intense as playing Major League Baseball is, or pitching every 3 to 4 days is, it's not necessarily the same thing as having to march all the way across North Africa or storm Normandy Beach. You don't know how lacking 4 toes is going to affect you at that point, and the army, for all its manpower needs, didn't need guys like that. That's the reason that they turned them down, whether it's because you're flat-footed or sunken-chested or have asthma or have a ridiculously bad prescription or anything like that. Guys got turned down for miserable teeth because of the Great Depression. No one had money for dentistry in the Great Depression, so there was an entire generation of young Americans who just didn't have choppers. In any case, they didn't turn them down out of charity or anything, but because you don't want soldiers who are going to be a burden to you or limit you in a combat situation. So there was no need for Ruffy to go. They didn't need him, but there was, he felt, a prejudice against him because of his career, that the fix was in. They were going to take him no matter what. And guess what? When they did take him, he played baseball. He did physical training. He was essentially a gym teacher in uniform. Some ball players, like Warren Spahn, like Bob Feller, either were assigned to combat duty or, in Feller's case, requested it. He was on the battleship Alabama and participated in some of the biggest engagements of the Pacific War. Obviously, players like him and Spahn and Cecil Travis made a real difference, and even those who played baseball for the duration made a difference because, hell, soldiers deserve entertainment too in the down times when they're not being shot at. But for many others, it was a waste of some vital years. Now, I'm not saying that the war against fascism was a waste of time, because it wasn't. It was a hugely important thing. These regimes were aggressive expansionist regimes, and they were capable of great evil that I don't need to detail for you here. Although I will say that the Nazis do take the top prize for their campaign of genocidal extermination, the Japanese treatment of prisoners of war and subject populations certainly earns them much more than an honorable mention in the barbarity category. In fact, if you're curious about this, the Man Booker Prize-winning novel from a couple years ago, 2015, by Richard Flanagan, was called The Narrow Road to the Deep North, and it treats the construction of the Burma Railway with prisoners of war from the point of view of Australian and British soldiers. It's the same stuff that was covered in a much more genteel way in the movie Bridge on the River Kwai. This is far more graphic and far more accurate. So no, it mattered. It mattered in so many ways. But for individual people, it could be a waste of time, and for Red Ruffing, it was a waste of time. And again, waste of time may not cover the collateral damage, whether to his career, whether to his family, whether to the baseball fans of the time that didn't get to see him perform at ages 38, 39, and for much of his age 40 season. He came back in late July, the very end of July, in 1945. And although you'd think that maybe we didn't lose much, he was actually still a pretty good pitcher. Again, injuries kept holding him back, as they do with older pitchers, but he was able to hang in until 1947 when he was 42. And this is, I guess, the thing that I want to say about that, about Red Ruffing, again, the most insignificant victim of World War II, perhaps, is that Winston Churchill once said, "It's better to jaw-jaw than to war-war. Better to talk than to fight." And when you dare war, when you create a non-zero chance of war, yes, maybe it won't happen, but maybe it will. Even if there's a 1 in 100 chance that it will, you can roll a 1 on the 100-sided die. Sure you can. You want to do your best to not have that option on the die whatsoever. To place it there, to do anything that might place it there, unless, as in World War II, it is absolutely necessary. You are creating a situation where, if the wrong number comes up on that die, and again, the point is not that it's a low percentage chance, it's that there's a percentage chance at all. Then you will disrupt or end the life of not only the current version of Charles Red Ruffing, whoever he is, but hundreds of thousands or millions of other people besides. It's not to be done lightly and certainly not out of self-aggrandizement or vainglory. And yeah, somewhere in there, a baseball season or two might be canceled or severely altered because Mike Trout is on a battleship somewhere. It's not just a game, and I mean that for both baseball and war. It's our lives, and the lives of the players that are involved. Almost 20 years ago now, I found myself speaking to Bob Feller, and this same subject was on my mind. And I asked him about how, when he first came up, the ethos that players like Ty Cobb and Rogers Hornsby had, that baseball was a war, was still prevalent. And he looked at me, and the veteran of the battleship Alabama said, "Anyone who thinks baseball is anything like a war hasn't been in a war." He was right about that. But what I'm saying here is that baseball is not only not like a war, it's very much like peace. We'll take a quick break for a word from our sponsors, and then I'll be back with Jesse Spector. In 1984, when Dave Winfield criticized the way George Steinbrenner ran the Yankees, Steinbrenner responded, "It is a tale told by an ignorant fuck."
It's a tale told by an ignorant fuck. Yeah, that's George, that's gold. Let's run with it.
Yeah, exactly. George Steinbrenner reached for Shakespeare and said of Winfield, "It is a tale told by an idiot that signifies nothing." He mangled the quote, but it's strange how little has changed in that time. And that seems like an appropriate way to bring back Jesse Spector. How are you, Jesse?
Well, I am an idiot, and the things that I say do tend to signify nothing. I am not sure that that's exactly what you were going for, but yeah, okay.
No, I wasn't trying to put you on the Winfield side of the equation, and I think that was very unfair to Winfield. I've had the fortune to talk to Winfield, who is an erudite and friendly individual, at least he has been to me. I don't know what he's like every day, obviously, but just the couple of conversations I've had with him, he was very nice.
I'd be happy to be on, you know, the same page, plane, whatever, with Dave Winfield any day. He's a fantastic human being.
He's still very, very large. And maybe the Aaron Judges of the world are now bigger than Dave Winfield was at the time that Dave Winfield played. He seemed just like out of scale to everybody else. And it was such an amazing feeling in a kind of a good way to stand next to him. I felt like some little kid in a fairy tale about a friendly giant just being. And I was an adult male at the time. I wasn't a little kid myself. And yet I am craning my neck to look at this guy who was so much fun to watch and was, you know, giving me the time of day. I'm supposed to be jaded about this stuff, but it that to that extent that I still have my fan worship, I felt that very acutely.
He would have fit in with this current Yankees outfield. I think he's, you know, he'd be the shortest of three if they went with a three-man outfield of Judge, Stanton, Winfield. But you know, he was 6'6". Because he was drafted in the ABA.
And football.
Yeah, because he was drafted four times.
Yeah. And the only thing he missed on was hockey, basically.
Mm-hmm. Which is disappointing because he's from Minnesota.
Yeah, exactly. That you'd think he would have at least had a glancing interaction with hockey growing up in Minnesota. But when you have a 6'6 stride, you cover acres in a few steps.
Basically built like Rob Gronkowski, but 30 years earlier. So I would imagine that he would have been a devastating force as a in whatever he chose. And he certainly was in baseball. I mean, he's in the Hall of Fame for a reason.
And he chose wisely because he doesn't have CTE now, at least I assume not. Except for I was just talking to our comrade here, Cliff Corcoran, about this, the famous Jerry Coleman call when Winfield was with the Padres and Coleman was the broadcaster, which he was for forever for the Padres. He made a call, something to the effect of, and Winfield goes back, 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 back. He hits his head on the wall. It rolls back towards the infield. Something like that. So, but he recovered from that whole decapitation thing and was just fine for many years after. No, the reason I bring it up, I don't know how explicitly political we want to be tonight, but we were talking about this a bit just before I pressed the big red record button here. This is where the tale told by an idiot sort of comes in. Without identifying the idiot, it occurred to me that where we are sitting now here in January of 2018, we are almost equidistant from this point to A, the crowning of the next Baseball World Series champion, which will resolve somewhere around the beginning of November, if not the end of October, and the 2018 midterm elections, which will determine a lot about the future of our nation and the tales told by an idiot. And so I was wondering which you are looking forward to more.
Ooh, one of them is far more important. The other is something that I actually enjoy and look forward to with no trepidation whatsoever. So I guess I'm looking forward to the baseball more because I am fearful of the elections. I think, you know, it's not that, you know, the winds are clearly blowing politically in a certain direction, and that direction is away from the guy who was elected in 2016. You know, you see all of the elections that happened in 2017. There were massive swings to the left. But, you know, there's kind of this international force out there that mucked around with the last major election that we had, and
I hadn't heard.
Why do we have any thought that that's not going to happen again? Like, I don't know. I feel like, yeah, there's a lot of reasons. Like, if you're anti-Trump, to be optimistic about what happens in November, but there's a long way politically between now and November for one thing, and then for another thing, like, is it all going to be on the up and up? And I'm fearful of that and what it will mean. And it's just one of those, I hope everything goes okay. And I hope that, you know, the American people have their voices really and truly heard. Baseball, I'm not worried about. Baseball, I can just look forward to. So yay, baseball. And maybe at some point, players will find teams between now and February when, you know, we got like 5 weeks left before pitchers and catchers. And I know the pitchers and catchers is not the end-all, be-all, and I've railed against that enough in my lifetime that pitchers and catchers is a false flag, yep. And you know they get our hopes up for pictures of dudes in gym shorts, to which people say, what's wrong with pictures of dudes in gym shorts? And I say, nothing, it's just not my thing. I'd like to actually watch baseball. Perfectly nice that it's a landmark, pitchers and catchers. It's a sign that it's like Groundhog Day. It's like, we're going to get through this. You know, we're going to make it. Spring is coming, but it's taken as spring is here. Spring is not here. I will be the day the pitchers and catchers report, barring a phenomenal turn in the way that this winter is going, I will be continuing to freeze my butt off. I don't want to hear that spring is here because some dudes showed up in Florida and Arizona and took physicals, but there are free agents out there, and I know that it's a bad free agent class, but they don't all suck. And not all of these teams are so good that they can't use these guys. So maybe at some point we'll see something else happen. I don't know. I hope so.
I remember when I was younger and I was a more naive fan and just, yeah, pitchers and catchers. It's all finally happening. And I remember turning on, this was in the kind of back when we had, you know, five channels days, not when we had 900 cable channels. And my dad was a holdout on cable anyway. So I had five channels much longer than most other people had five channels. But I turned on whatever the 6 o'clock news and they said, and now turning to sports, pitchers and catchers reported today. And behind the announcer was a film, a nanosecond clip, basically. And here the Mets catchers are at Mets camp working out. And you saw maybe a half second of Gary Carter and Barry Lyons or somebody sort of doing this weird frog hop around the field, which I guess was supposed to limber them up for a year of squatting. And then they cut to Sid Fernandez or Ron Darling or somebody throwing the ball to said catchers who are now extremely limber after their frog hopping. And then they said, and now turning to hockey. And it's like, wait, that's it? That's all we get? No, wait, I want baseball news. I want information. And you're right. There's nothing that happens. And then for me, the frustration is it goes on for 6 weeks after that you have the 2 weeks of pitchers and catchers. And then you have a month of fake games. And the first fake game is novel to me because we haven't seen anything like real baseball since the last Out of the World Series. So it's fun for the two at-bats that the regulars get. And maybe you see some prospects that you haven't seen in this setting before that you've been hearing about for a long time. But to have like 25 of these things, I don't know what they really need physically to be ready or for the staff to evaluate their players. But it drags on forever, and it just seems to me it's more about the Florida economy or the Arizona economy and bringing a few extra bucks in that setting than it is about getting ready for the season in real terms.
Yeah, it's about the economy and about the fact they've built this into a gigantic business. I mean, they fill up those parks pretty much all over Phoenix, and it's just Phoenix. It's not anywhere else in Arizona now, and it's Phoenix and it's assorted places that are not really Phoenix, but are Phoenix. Glendale is Phoenix. Come on. If somebody really wants to get upset, Glendale has its own fire department that they gutted to pay for the Arizona Coyotes to have their arena there. Fine, whatever. Yes, Glendale is its own municipality. But it's like if the entirety of spring training was conducted in, I don't know, what is comparable? Los Angeles and environs. If it was like, this team is training in downtown LA. This team is training in Burbank. This team is training in Glendale. It's all LA. it's all Phoenix. Fly to the Phoenix airport. You don't drive outside of you do go outside of the Loop Highway a little bit to get to Surprise or whatever. You do go, but it's not like Florida where it's the Phoenix thing and it's Florida. And they abandoned Tucson and I'm sad that they did. I understand why they did, but whatever. It's neither here nor there. It's all this. It's a giant economy now and good for them. It's fun. It's a lot of fun to go there if you're there for a few days, which I think, most people are. Or if you're a retiree, you get to watch, a month of baseball in the setting of your retirement community, especially like in Jupiter. Like that park is like right in the middle of a basically retirement community. And it's pretty cool. It's nice for those people. I would imagine if you're a Cardinals fan, you retire to Jupiter, you get to watch the Cardinals every other day for a month in March, and that's a nice way to spend your time. So good for them on all of that. I cannot imagine paying actual attention to it, which is something that I guess I'm going to have to do now since I'm hosting a Yankees podcast, Locked On Yankees. Stay tuned for that because it's going to be great throughout the month of March while I'm doing God knows what, because the Yankees are going to have – what are they going to have to decide?
Maybe quite a bit, actually.
Who's going to play second base for 6 weeks until Gleyber Torres is ready? I think that they're going to have third base figured out by the time they get to camp, and I think they're going to have the entire pitching staff filled out by the time they get to camp.
Well, I'm glad you brought this up because, obviously, I wanted to ask you about what I jokingly called an email the other day, Locks on Yankees, which is the New York version, direct from Zabar's, the deli version. But no, it's Locked On Yankees. It's a new podcast. Yeah. You've been doing it for a while now. How many episodes in are you?
Well, after we get done recording this, I'll be recording episode 9.
How many times a week are you doing it?
Two or three times a week during the off season, and then it'll be 5x a week once the season gets going. And it's a lot of me talking. Thankfully, the plans do include having guests such as, let's check my notes here, Steve Goldman. I don't know. He's going to be on episode 9. Some guy who hosts another podcast.
I hear he's been drinking today, so that should be interesting.
Oh, okay. Well, it's been fun, and hopefully it will continue to be fun. It's just I really didn't realize how much talking I was going to do, and I suppose that I am capable of it. So, yeah, talking, me, listen, show, good, yay, better than this.
So how many minutes are you doing per episode? I mean, during the offseason, I assume it's pretty quick.
They're all going to be in the 22 to 30 range, I think. I think that's the plan with a daily show. The idea is that it be something that you can listen to on your commute. So
right. Get a reaction to last night's game, get some news. I will say, since you're talking about how much talking you're doing, this is episode 36 of this show, and you know that each episode runs approximately 17 years. So a lot of not just you and I talking or you and whoever has dropped by that week talking, but whatever stories I choose to tell. And the editing function is your friend. People have congratulated me on how relatively polished I sound. And to some extent, sometimes if I'm having a particularly high mental acuity day, those are fewer and fewer. I do manage to kind of ad-lib my way through it without making a lot of mistakes, but I make a lot of them. And as I don't really script things, if you're smarter than me, you'll also script things. So I have this mistaken idea that I should try to sound spontaneous. So I have a few notes, and then as I'm talking, I may lose the thread. So it's good to go back and say I'm talking about the Cubs or you're talking about the Yankees. If it were me, I'd be saying, and Greg Bird is injured again. There's still a lot of hope for him. There have been some cracks in the media about the fact that he doesn't want to play. Those comments may be coming from within the Yankees. They're a little disturbed by the fact that Mom didn't love me. Why? Why didn't she love? And see, that stuff, that's the stuff that I take out. Mostly. Sometimes I leave it, but mostly if it's not on the spine of the story I'm telling, I do go back and erase it. So just take advantage of that. But it will take you, by that method, approximately 4 hours to record every 15 minutes because you'll constantly be going back and taking out those moments.
Yeah. The thing that I've been doing, I have been scripting it a decent amount, especially the parts where I've interviewed people, because I've had a few guests on. Those have not been scripted. Those are all... I don't even really write out questions for that. And you'll see, we will talk and I will have written out nothing. And in fact, as we speak now, I don't even really have subject material planned. We're just going to talk about the Yankees.
And that's good because they're pretty much the only team, along with their partners in some of that activity, the Marlins, that have done anything. We've had this weird offseason in which the Yankees picked up Giancarlo Stanton. And the Marlins dispersed some of their better players elsewhere, and the Angels signed Shohei Ohtani. And that's mostly it. Wade Davis is supposedly with the Rockies. That hasn't been official yet.
No, that's official.
Oh, okay. It is official. Then Carlos Santana's with the Phillies. Mitch Moreland re-signed with the Red Sox. It's really weird. And I wanted to ask you about this because it's not just for the Yankees, but as things stand now, we had all these divisions in baseball last year that were not decided by anything like a close race. The Yankees, they were two games behind the Red Sox. That was one of the few close ones. I would assume that those two things, if you projected them now, would flip. But otherwise, the Rays, Jays, and Orioles were way back there. None of that. There's no reason for any of that to have changed. The Indians were 17 games up on their competition. I don't see why that should have changed. The Astros finished 21 up on the AL West, despite some of the improvements the Angels have made, and I do think they're real. They were still 80-82, and it's hard to project this massive, massive swing for them. So just sticking with the AL for a second, there's still, it seems like, either a lot of complacency or a lot of work to be done.
The Rays seem to have made a decision that, you know, they might have to go for something of a reload here, but they're never really not doing that in some way or another. They just got rid of the big contract that they have with Longoria. And I guess that maybe they do think about trading Chris Archer. Let's be honest. They're not catching the Red Sox and the Yankees. I think even the Red Sox, it's a little bit questionable with them right now, what they're going to be doing, what they're up to. They're in a spot where they need to basically get rid of Hanley Ramirez. But Hanley Ramirez was one of the few guys on that team that hit any kind of home runs last year. So what do you do? Because they need to, everybody needs to get under the 197. And that's what's killing everything around baseball, just market-wise, I think, is that at the top of the market, you have the Yankees to do much of anything else beyond like adding, you know, they could trade for a Gerrit Cole or a Chris Archer, somebody who's under team control as a pitcher. But until and unless they get out from under Jacoby Ellsbury, they're not doing anything else. The Dodgers made their move, you know, with getting rid of Adrian Gonzalez. And I'm not really entirely clear on how all of that manipulation worked with what they did with Atlanta. And, you know, the big teams want to get under. The other teams don't want to overpay anybody. And you're just kind of in this weird, sticky holding pattern where, especially in the American League, like, yeah, everybody knows it's these teams that are good. And I guess, yeah, the Twins are trying. They're trying from a perspective of, we were in the playoffs last year, and who did they get that was not impressive?
Fernando Rodney.
Yeah, that's going to really lock things down for them.
And Zach Duke. Those are their big offseason acquisitions.
I mean, to be fair, their bullpen did cost them that game against the Yankees in the wild card, so it is important for them to upgrade it. I'm not sure that 87-year-old Fernando Rodney necessarily fits the bill. He can still pitch, I guess, right?
He was with the Diamondbacks, and the odd bad outing will distort your record.
That's right. He was with another playoff team. Sure.
Another one that has more or less stood pat so far and will probably, I guess, lose J.D. Martinez, who was a big part once he came over. He hit like Babe Ruth.
I don't know what they're doing because they've been like talking about trading Greinke and talking about trading Patrick Corbin and talking about trading Brandon Drury, who's, you know, one of their under control guys for years and plays a ton of positions. And why would you want to get rid of that guy? I haven't understood the Diamondbacks for a long time, and I'm not about to start. So
no, well, we can stay in the American League for a second. One thing I've been curious about, and maybe this goes to what you were saying about the salary cap and the penalties associated with that. Why doesn't anyone want to liberate Jose Abreu from the White Sox? He's done nothing but hit. He's not the world's worst defensive first baseman. He's not Don Mattingly either, but he's at least playable there. And he's now an island on a team that is almost wholly comprised of prospects and random bits that they're going to sort through on their way to a rebuilding. He seems like an obvious guy to move along with Avisiel Garcia, but he has a better track record than Garcia, who I think is probably a good bet to regress in the coming year.
I've been a Garcia fan for pretty much since he was a prospect with the Tigers. So I'm maybe a little bit on the other side of this, that he's a guy I would keep around. And I feel like when it comes to Abreu, though, where would he fit? I can't think of a team that would be like, oh, yeah, let's give the White Sox a huge package in a trade to marginally upgrade at first base, because that's kind of what you're talking about. The teams that would be in the market for Jose, I guess, you know, the Astros have Gurriel, the Yankees have Bird, the Red Sox
re-sign Moreland. The Red Sox
would make sense, but they re-sign Mitch Moreland and they can't really take that on. They can't take on that kind of, you know, a Jose Abreu contract anyway. Cardinals, I guess, would make sense, but right now the Cardinals, They're in such a weird spot anyway, where like everybody there is getting old. They're not catching the Cubs as they are currently constituted. And I think that like the last 2 years ago, they came right down and they missed the wild card, lost, you know, to the Mets and the Giants. And yeah, you know, they were right there in it. And then last year, I think that they maybe kind of fooled themselves a bit, you know, with the idea that they were still in it because the Cubs were lousy. Had the Cubs been, you know, what they were, really, and the team that they were is the team that they were for the second half. They just took a while to get it going for whatever the reasons are. And I think that, you know, I hate talking about the championship hangover because I think that it's a bunch of hokum, but does occasionally come into play with certain teams. I think the team, if ever there was a team that was going to have that happen to them, it would be a young Cubs team that went through a 7-game World Series and then was the Cubs and won the World Series for the first time in 108 years. I can see those guys having been a little bit out of sorts going into the next season. But, you know, they came back, and the Brewers were really the team that took advantage. And the Cardinals were a meh team that boosted themselves up by playing in a division with garbagey Pirates team and a super garbagey Reds team.
Well, and they also kind of pulled players out of their butt, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
When Alamides Diaz slumped in his sophomore year, they bring up Paul DeJong. They bring Tommy Pham in, and he hasn't always stayed healthy, but he played exceedingly well. He's like a 29-year-old kid, basically, at least in terms of experience. And then at first base, and as far as I know, this guy is still slotted to play there, Jose Martinez, another 28-year-old with not a ton of experience, who played exceedingly well. So yeah, they've gotten Marcell Ozuna since then, which is a huge, huge thing, but they need one more. And not being self-deceptive, to characterize it the way you did, and saying, well, now this guy who is 28 or 29 is going to be 30 next year and he's going to do this fluky thing that he did last year again, it might be smarter to go get another veteran.
Do you really like Marcell Ozuna, though? He's a pretty good ball player, but like, does that trade really do it for you?
Well, he had a huge year. He hasn't been consistent at that level. It's a question of whether he can do it again. But at his age, and you hope, this is always another naive thing to say, well, in a more professional and committed environment, he will play up to the competition. That doesn't always happen. The player is the player. But
Yeah.
A 300 average, 37 home runs, 145 OPS plus. Again, you have to discount everybody last year given the level of offense, but still, that's pretty good. And he's only going to be 27, so he shouldn't fall off the face of the earth exactly.
At the same time, and I know that this is wildly exaggerating to make a point, because they did have a really good outfield there. They traded for the worst starting outfielder on a sub 500 team. Mostly what I'm wondering is, why wouldn't you just go after Yelich? Like, why would you not?
He's the better guy.
Christian Yelich is better.
Yeah.
And you're obviously in a position where the poker thing is, you know, look for the mark. And basically, if you can't find the mark, it's you. Well, I think everybody in baseball knows who the mark is right now. And it's the Marlins.
Right.
Like, they're over a barrel. And say what you will about the Loria years, because they were terrible. But there was at least some baseball competency at play there, that they did assemble that outfield. And Loria, you know, messed around with Ozuna and had him sent to the minors. And they went through all that shtick. And nobody wanted to play there because it's a garbage organization. And tons of reasons to not play there. And you know, they had a guy die. So that was also real bad. And not the fault of ownership in any way, shape, or form. But, you know, before Jose Fernandez died, they were a team that seemed like they were kind of on the move in the right direction from a baseball standpoint. And I think that you have to give some credit to the people that were doing that on a shoestring. I don't see El Capitan down there making a lot of savvy baseball decisions.
Just a heads up, as someone who worked with Yankees.com and the Yes Network for 100 years and blogged about them at the Pinstripe Bible for that company for forever, that if you were going to be a camp follower for the Yankees, I tell you this as a friend, Jesse, you can't talk about El Capitan that way. I spent my youth, I blew my prime years talking about Derek Jeter's defense, and it was as if I had spit on mom the flag and apple pie. And I'm just going to tell you, if you want your mentions to stay clean, you have to modulate that Derek Jeter stuff.
I think there's been a turn on that. I think that, you know, as far, like, I think people have, like, seen, and this has been one of the amazing things that happened in just, It's been happening for a few years now, to take a wrestling term, the double turn of Derek Jeter and Alex Rodriguez in the past, you know, 3 or 4 years, but really culminating in 2017 with, you know, A-Rod being this personable, enjoyable fellow who shows up on television and wears his ring and, like, plays the role of, like, haha, I want a ring with the Yankees. And even though David Ortiz has three, I'm going to rub my Yankees ring in his face and everybody's going to enjoy the heck out of that. And then he's out gallivanting with J-Lo, and everybody loves them as a couple. Meanwhile, here's Derek Jeter becoming Mr. Bad Business, fire Jeff Conine and Andre Dawson and send them out into the street and get rid of the broadcaster who, you know, was terrible, but everybody in Miami loved. Trade the MVP for pennies. It's mind-blowing to see that, like, A-Rod has become one of the faces of baseball and all that is good and love of the game. And Derek Jeter is just another slimy business weasel. It's fascinating.
I think that aspect of it was predictable in a sense, maybe not the A-Rod turn, although A-Rod was a guy who always tried to say things and tried to open up. He just always was bad at it. And somehow, as he's walked away and gone into retirement, he's much more relaxed. And as you said, very personable, very interesting to listen to when he's doing commentary and stuff. Jeter never opened up to anybody, was always there and always on the camera, but was a font of cliches. And so how you value Jeter was how you projected his performance. He was what he did, in other words. So if he's out there and he's hitting 320 and hitting November World Series home runs and so on, then you'd think he's the greatest guy. Now, again, we don't know anything about him, really. So what we have is him tearing down a franchise, and he looks like a jerk. And he, in our 25 years of knowing him, or however long it's been, has offered no countervailing evidence to balance things out.
Yeah. My lasting image of Derek Jeter, as at least in my job, is that he would always be there and be willing to answer any question that you had, and he would give you a non-answer. But it was always, and if he didn't have time, it would be like, oh, not right now, buddy. It was always buddy this and buddy that. And it's just such a, it was so disingenuous. That's always stuck with me. And I know that I'm not the only one that feels that way. Just like, hey, buddy. Whereas A-Rod, I think that where it happened for A-Rod was actually when he got suspended. You know, he spent that year away and kind of during that year, like, went around to, like, Miami football games and, like, was at kids' baseball games and doing all kinds of, you know, just things that A-Rod wanted to do. And he came back and he stopped trying to be cool. He stopped trying to be the things that everybody, that he had always thought everybody wanted him to be, because that was gone now. And he was just, he embraced the fact that he is a huge dork. And he really is a huge, huge dork, but it's enjoyable because he owns it now. Like, he loves baseball. He loves the heck out of baseball. He loves other sports too. But, like, he's such, like, a baseball nerd, and he's just a huge dork. Like, you can picture A-Rod, like, making really stupid puns and embarrassing his daughters in just the silliest ways in, and this is without even knowing the guy. Like, you can see him doing that. Whereas, like, I cannot picture Derek Jeter interacting with other human beings. Just can't. It's weird. Like, I can't imagine him, like, going downstairs and having coffee in the morning with his wife. It's just like, it's a non thing. Whereas, like, I don't really have a mental image of, like, what J-Lo is like as a person, but, like, I can imagine them interacting, and, like, you see them on Instagram videos or whatever, and they're just, like, having fun as people, and, you know, great for them. And, you know, time eventually gives you the opportunity, I guess, to see who people are, or at least, you know, the world that we live in gives you the chance to see who people are. And I feel like A-Rod has taken advantage of that in a much better way than Jeter ever did, and he figured that out. So good for him, because whoever saw that day coming? I certainly didn't.
I want to circle back to the Cardinals for a second, just out of fairness to them.
Yeah, no, please do.
I think that the way that they land on Ozuna instead of Yelich, who's the more interesting player, is that, A, they're looking for power, and Ozuna's the more pure power play. But more importantly, they made a play on Stanton. Stanton said no, he didn't want to go there, so they're boxed out there. And Ozuna's heading for arbitration, and Yelich is on a contract that pays something like $50 million over 7 years. So it's a really nice contract. One makes the Marlins a motivated seller, the other doesn't. And so I could see how they would get maneuvered into, and again, Ozuna may have been their taste anyway, because they need somebody who looks kind of like a cleanup hitter or a number three hitter, and they just didn't really have that last year. But I'm not saying that Yelich, to interrupt myself for the third time, I'm not saying that Yelich isn't that guy, but he's not the pure slugger. He's more of the all-around hitter. He's the Bernie Williams, and those guys never are somehow are never as attractive as the pure power hitters. So I just think it's a combination of those factors that led them to taking Ozuna.
I think that's fair. I just think Marcell Ozuna is not bridging the gap between where the Cardinals are and where the Cubs are. It's just not happening. And it's not like the Cubs are going to get significantly worse, I don't think. Like, they did lose Wade Davis. They presumably are losing Arrieta, but Arrieta wasn't great for them this year.
No, but I do think, though, that there is a question there, because their rotation as it stands now is Lester, Jose Quintana, Kyle Hendricks, Tyler Chatwood, and Mike Montgomery. And I like Chatwood, but he walks a lot of guys. He gets a lot of grounders, so that's really cool. But he walks a lot of guys, isn't always healthy. Montgomery has never shown that he can be a durable starter. Lester wasn't great. He's getting up there in dog years. And as great as Quintana has been, he's also the kind of pitcher that will sometimes lose it. I'm not saying he will. Ditto Hendricks, same deal. So I'm not necessarily forecasting that. I'm just saying there's not an ace there. Now, look, they could turn around and sign Yu Darvish or somebody who's still out there, or re-sign Arrieta, because nothing has happened, and you'd think prices are going to come down somewhat just as guys look for a home, any home. But right now, that rotation seems a little thin to me.
Have you heard it's in the stars? Next July, we collide with Mars. Well, did you ever? What a swell party, a swell party, a swell-igan, elegant party. this is.
Steve here, interrupting to say we'll be right back with more conversation between me and Jesse Spector right after this message from our sponsors.
I think that they will add to that rotation before it's all said and done. And even if it's somebody like a Chris Tillman, certainly they've had success in the past with reclaiming Orioles starters. So, you know, Arrieta might be you might have seen the best of him. I think you certainly have seen the best of him. I don't think he's going back to the God mode that he was in, where he was contending with Clayton Kershaw for a Cy Young.
We all have only so many years like that in us, if any.
He's going to get paid big off of that. He's not going to get paid as big as Scott Boras would like him to, but he's not going to live up to the contract that he gets. Part of this offseason is that everybody kind of knows that, but somebody's eventually going to feel like, oh, I got to do this, and they will. And it's just kind of you wait around and see who that is. The smarter teams will be the ones who play themselves out of that by getting other starting pitchers before that happens.
Well, I think that's true of everybody. I mean, that's one reason, and people have pointed to the salary cap. You just pointed to the salary cap as one reason things are so slow. But the other reason is who really excites you, who really moves the needle in terms of the free agents. Trades are a different thing. A trade could happen anytime, and I wish they did happen anytime. But I just mentioned Darvish. Darvish did not look great in the postseason. We might have seen the best of Darvish too. JD Martinez, again, is he going to slug 750 where he goes next? Probably not. And he doesn't want a DH. He's not a great defensive outfielder. Eric Hosmer has a 7-year offer from the Padres, which strikes me as something that requires some kind of psychiatric intervention. He's not.
If that's really true, that Eric Hosmer has a 7-year offer from the Padres, why did he not sign it immediately?
It would be a nice city to spend 7 years in. I'll give you that. You won't win a lot of games necessarily, and you won't hit very many home runs. I don't know. I don't know what else he's looking at, but he's not that kind of player that you want to lock him up till he's what, in his mid-30s. So, and you can just go down the list that way. Arrieta, like you said, we've seen the most of them or the best of them. Moustakas is a platoon guy with a 300 career on base. Lorenzo Cain, I've talked about a bunch of times because he's kind of old for a guy you're going to give a 4 or 5 year deal to and isn't the most consistent or healthiest player. Now we're down to like Lance Lynn and Jay Bruce, and pretty soon you're looking at Logan Morrison and Lucas Duda and guys like that. And again, why would you put up a premium for these kinds of players who might move you up a win or so, but not necessarily are they going to close that 20 freaking game gap between you and the Nationals?
No, I think that's as much as anything. And that's the other thing that's really holding back free agency is that teams have gotten smarter and are looking at things and saying, okay, yeah, Mike Moustakas might help us this year. If I give Mike Moustakas 5 years and $80 million, what am I doing to my 2022 team? Right. I am causing problems for myself. And I would like to believe as a general manager that I'm going to have this job for the length of a 5-year contract that I sign a guy to because I'm smart. So if I'm going to sign a guy for 5 years, it ain't going to be that guy. It ain't going to be pretty much anybody who's on this market right now. I think that, you know, AJ Preller is in that he don't care. He's playing with house money of the fact that he has a job right now, because that's the way that things have gone there. It's kind of amazing that he is still employed. I don't think that he's incapable of doing the job. I think that he swung for the fences 2 years ago, missed, and you know, tried to make the best of a bad situation after that, with plenty of skullduggery in the mix as well with everything that went down with the Red Sox. So, and John Coppola kind of got him off the hook of being the dirtiest player in the game. So, you know, good for him on that too. So he feels like he can go out and try again. He's not going to have that job in another 7 years. So what does he care if he signs Eric Hosmer to a 7-year deal? Great. For everybody else, teams are really thinking now, well, I will have to pay this giant salary in 4 years. And you know, there's enough warning contracts out there. And I think that teams are aware of this now. And what are some of the stories of this offseason? Yankees want to move Jacoby Ellsbury, who they gave a giant free agent contract to. Red Sox want to move Hanley Ramirez, who they gave a giant free agent contract to. The Dodgers did offload Adrian Gonzalez and Scott Kazmir and Brandon McCarthy, who all had outsized contracts of, you know, one form or another.
They had to take Matt Kemp back, of course.
They did, but, you know, we're able to wrangle that into whatever, or are going to be, What have they done with him? Has anything happened there?
He's still there. And I hope someone would take mercy on him and make him a DH, because he, according at least to the stats, may be the worst outfielder in the history of outfielders.
I mean, only because I never played in the major leagues.
Well, that's setting a low bar, but you can see it in all in the StatCast stuff, in the more standard defensive metrics, and in the films for that matter. He just doesn't get to anything. And this is a guy who used to play center field, didn't play it well. I think he was about minus 40 defensive runs saved for the Dodgers one year, which again, you'd think you'd have to fall down on every play. But I mean, Lonnie Smith did fall down on every play and he was never minus 40. So I will say, given what you're saying, at some point we've got 40 days. This has got to end somewhere. Somebody has got to be willing to take less money or fewer years. And if that happens, then you can look at these guys in a newer way, because Arrieta, right? He's not going to be a Cy Young guy again. We know that. And if he is, he's not going to be the guy with a 1.77 ERA. But if you look at him on, say, the Astros, and you say, well, we can sign him for 2-3 years and we don't have to rely on a Charlie Morton or a Brad Peacock in our rotation. And now he's not a star. He's accent furniture. That, I think, does move the needle for them in terms of not only making sure that you win the division again and you have the depth to win the division again, but then you go to the postseason. And again, you're not piecing it together the way that they, it was exciting to watch with a Lance McCullers appearance here and a Verlander game there and so on, but they wouldn't have to do it the same way.
I think that's reasonable. I think that the other thing that comes into it is if you have one of the big teams say, you know what, we're going to blow past the 197 and, you know, and the luxury tax threshold, the basically salary cap, as you've put it, appropriately, blow past that, forget about next winter, because dudes are going to get overpaid. We'll get decent talent now, especially if you have a strong farm system. And here I'm thinking of the Yankees and the Dodgers specifically, but they seem to be playing for the 197. But if you have a team with a good farm system, you're in position to contend now. You don't think that, you know, don't think you're going to be able to get Bryce Harper or Manny Machado or whoever else is on, you know, you're not going to be able to get Josh Donaldson, not going to be able to get any of the guys that are on the market next year. Go for it now. You know, wait for the prices to come down a little bit more. Make your splash now with this free agent market. Yeah, it's flawed. I don't know if it's a winning plan, but it might be your best shot. And maybe you're taking that shot now, because you're certainly looking at the Yankees and Dodgers trying to gear themselves up to be super teams. And that could really change the shape of things from next year moving forward. Maybe the Cubs are the team that has to do that. I don't know.
I was going to call you a Yankees expert now that you're doing the show that you're doing. And it occurred to me in a past episode, when we always end up talking about the Mets, and you had said at one point, the Mets aren't even my team. And yet we've talked about them in great depth and with great feeling. And I don't think I've ever asked you if you had a team growing up or before you turned pro and checked your private provincial interest, put it in a blind trust for the duration of your career. Who did you follow back in the day?
I've been open about this. I don't think that we've talked about it here, but I've been pretty open about this. I grew up a fan of both the Yankees and the Mets. It did not matter. Nobody ever really seemed to care in the 1980s and 1990s, up until I was 16 years old. They played each other for the first time. It was at Yankee Stadium. And I said, I went with actually a bunch of Mets fans to see Dave Malicki shut out the Yankees. But I was like, I'm not going to Yankee Stadium, where I've been going my entire life. I've been going to Shea too. I'm not going there and booing the home team. So I, you know, at that moment was picked the Yankees over the Mets. I still have liked the Mets. I like both. At this point, you know, it's become, over the past few years professionally, I have been enthusiastic about both New York teams, because they are, their success is good for me personally. professionally, like, you know, the Mets went to the World Series and I got to spend most of October 2015 at home, you know, at a time when I had a 2-year-old and a 7-month-old at the time. So that was really cool that was something that happened. And I was very happy that the Mets were in the World Series that year. Last year, Yankees went to the ALCS. I would not have been covering playoffs had the Yankees not been in them. So I was really happy that that was something that happened. And now I am hosting a Yankees show. So yeah, the Yankees, if they are good, which they should be, their success bodes well for me to have more interest in that team and more people listening to my show. So it's not what it was for me as a fan growing up. It is more personally, professionally tied. But yeah, it's still the same teams that I grew up with are the teams who I have the highest interest in now, as it happens.
I let that go somewhere. I know when and why it happened. I felt personally alienated in a sense because I got to see too much of how the sausage was made. And that wasn't just as a result of my experience working with, yes, those guys were great to me, actually. It was knowing people who worked for the Yankees and seeing how they were treated and just feeling increasingly like somebody that was taken for granted, that the fans were not, and this may be true of a lot of teams, although I've been told it's not, are just looked upon as people to be exploited for money. Mm-hmm. And the employees at that time, and this is when George Steinbrenner was still alive, were not treated well and were badly abused in some cases. And those people who were doing the abusing are still the people in charge today. And so somewhere my enthusiasm for it, yay, they won the World Series, and then seeing those same people accept trophies started to really turn my stomach in a way, and I lost the feeling that I had.
Yeah, I can see that, and I feel a lot the same way. Like, I'm not emotionally invested the way that I was, and I think the way that I would be had I not gotten into this. And I certainly, where it really comes up for me as far as having done this job, having done, you know, baseball writing as a job, is that, and sports writing in general, is that I don't hate teams, and I just don't anymore. Like, I have some antipathy for a few teams based on how I've interacted with various people, either fans of that team or employees of that team, whether professionally or on the internet or whatever. There are some teams that I have a distaste for as a result of that. But I will say that there was one team that was in the playoffs last year that I was very conflicted on, because they have one of my favorite humans in baseball, yet also at the same time, they are a team that, for a variety of reasons, I would rather did not exist.
Yeah. That's a bit extreme.
Yeah, no, I feel comfortable with that. And I think that anybody who follows me can figure out exactly which of the playoff teams from last year that is. So there's that. But, like, you know, I grew up, the Red Sox, it was, they're the Red Sox. You don't root for the Red Sox ever. They're the Red Sox. I grew up in a household where that was just how it was. You know, the Red Sox were, you know, essentially Satan. You know, not in that deep of a way, but where they actually were looked at that. But, like, you know, they're the Red Sox. They're no way, no how, not the Red Sox. I kind of like them the last couple of years. Like, just as far as, you know, Mookie Betts is an awesome player to watch and a cool guy to talk to. Same for, you know, Jackie Bradley Jr. I've been disappointed to see what's happened between David Price and the Boston media, because, you know, he's kind of ruined now. But, you know, when he was with Tampa and even, you know, with Detroit, yeah, like, he was an awesome guy to deal with, and a guy who, like, was one of those, like, kind of mind-blowing for, like, how encyclopedic his knowledge of, like, everything he's done in baseball is. Like, he was able to tell me a pitch that he had thrown to Joey Votto in an interleague game 3 years earlier and was exactly right about it. So, like, in an otherwise, like, meaningless way. And it was, like, it was unprompted, like, it was prompted by me asking him about, but he didn't know that I was going to be asking him about it. So that was kind of amazing. And the one that I always go back to on this, it isn't baseball, but hockey. Boy, did I could not stand the New Jersey Devils. You know, I would routinely tell people the Devils ruined hockey by playing the neutral zone trap, played a very boring brand of hockey, couldn't stomach the New Jersey Devils, not to mention the fact that, you know, they had gotten three cups. My beloved Rangers had only gotten the one, although they did beat the Devils in 94 in the great 94 Eastern Conference final that went to double overtime in game seven. Fantastic hockey series. This is not a hockey show, and I will stop talking about it now. The icon of those Devils teams was Martin Brodeur, the goalie. And I cracked jokes at Brodeur's expense for years as a Rangers fan, and, you know, wind up and go as a hockey writer and talk to Brodeur, and he's one of the amazing, like, hockey players are generally good quotes in general, but Brodeur is like one of the amazing quotes and great storytellers, and like would just stand in front of his locker for half an hour just talking about anything and everything, free and easy, not a care about like how any of it was interpreted, because he was just giving it to you straight, and it was fantastic. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess I don't hate this guy. He's not the Antichrist in goalie pads. Okay, worldview changed. And now I work for the Devils and write stories for them once a week. So, yay.
Well, there's a certain maturation that comes too. And
is there?
I think so, because, I mean, look, when your hobby becomes your job, it changes your relationship to it. That's one. Number two, you can say, look, on one hand, we can say there were reasons to dislike the Red Sox that had nothing to do with baseball back then, at least when I was a kid, because Tommy Yawkey was still alive. And that was the most racist of racist organizations that there ever was, even sure. Then. And that's when they had guys like Jim Rice. It still wasn't great. Now that's not true. And what we can do is, at least we hope it's not true, and we can look at the Red Sox and say, you know, from Theo on, they've had a plan, hasn't always worked, but they've run themselves pretty darn well, and I appreciate that. The Cubs were a pathetic organization for most of 100 years. At one point, their general manager was a seafood wholesaler. I mean, but now, again, I don't want to make it all about Theo, but they have a very good plan. And so I like excellence in all things. It's like going to a museum and seeing a great work of art or something, some rare thing that you don't see often. You can appreciate it on that basis. Who cares what the uniforms are? None of the players are from these cities anyway. They're not representing civic pride. They're just representing what they represent. I mean, if they were representing civic pride, then we'd have to indict Miami along with Jeff Loria for the Marlins, and that doesn't seem fair to anybody. So I do think that you gain a distance on it, and it's a healthy distance. And yeah, you lose the foam finger part of yourself if you ever had that, the part of you that is going to wave a pennant and go rah rah. But you just you get to like it in a different way.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's the case for everybody. I look around and like just from reading stuff, like there's enough homers out there that I feel like that's not something that necessarily like that.
Homers in the professional population, you mean?
Yeah. I don't know that this is a thing that comes to everybody. I think it comes to you know, most of the people that you respect and who you actually want to interact with and talk with, because if it hasn't, like if you've done sports professionally and that hasn't come to you, then there's something it should come to you. I think that you're right, that you should lose that and that you should be able to look at things on a different level, especially like when you get to know people on different teams. Like if you grow up and, you know, you root for one team and they're your hometown team and you wind up going to work for that team and you only ever deal with the people on that team, I think that that's different than something else. But even if you do, I think that that can still come to you. And probably should. And I think that I really think that it should come to more people just generally, that at some point, and you know, maybe I'm taking too rosy of an outlook about just the way that humanity should work. But I think that, like, there should be a point where, like, if you're a 40-year-old man and you're, like, raving at 25-year-olds about how they suck and you know, they're a disgrace, and because they dropped a fly ball or they wear the wrong color uniform, like, examine yourself. I get it. I get that you dislike this team, but, like, there should be some kind of maturation and reeling it in from the time that you were a kid. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong about that. And maybe there is, you know, deeply ingrained tribalism that is healthy and is good, and that, you know, you really do just, I don't see it.
No, I don't think
that's true. No.
And to bring it full circle, and we've gone past the hour now, so we should wrap up. And I do have more Yankees conversation, but I guess we'll carry that over to Locked On Yankees. So,
lovely.
Guys, if you want to hear more Yankees talk between me and Jesse, head over there, because I assume he'll get that up before I get this up. But
yeah, that'll be up soon. Yeah. Shortly after we record, that will be up. But yes, definitely go back and look for it, because it will be it'll be good and enjoyable.
Exactly. Whereas it takes me a couple of days to, as I alluded to earlier, delete all the psychodrama. I was just, before we started talking, I was reading a magazine article and they had this picture, and you'd know it if you saw it, because it's one of the most widely repeated or reprinted pictures of 2017. It was a shot from that white supremacist rally in Charlottesville of this guy. He looks to be 21, 22, and he's just screaming. I don't know what he's screaming. The picture's obviously silent. We will not be replaced. Whatever it was they were shouting around the statue of Robert E. Lee. He looks so fervent. He looks so committed. He looks so hateful. And he looks so pathetic. And it just seems like you look at it and it's like looking at somebody who you don't recognize as belonging to the same community that you do. And thankfully they don't. But that's a very extreme version of the same thing. It's the most pernicious version. But somehow tribalism is a virus that infects every human to a greater extent or another. And if you've been inculcated with that, I think it's just very, very hard to let it go.
I think it is. And I think that, you know, I'm talking about how I don't think it's, you know, out of the grasp of everybody, even in a professional setting. So how can I possibly expect it to be out of the grasp of people for whom this is entertainment? We got a long way to go. At the same time,
they have a higher bar. I mean, the people who are fans, they're under less pressure to let it go because that's what they come to it for. If you're a professional, and this is something that I've talked about on the show in a number of different contexts, I think it depends why you became a commentator on baseball. And there are some people who want to tell stories or be an analyst, and that requires a certain amount of objectivity or dispassion. But then there are people, and there's not necessarily anything wrong with this, they love it so much that they want to be close to it. And this is the thing that they can find that's adjacent to baseball or is tangentially part of baseball, where no, they can't be on a team. No, they can't be the general manager of the Milwaukee Brewers, but they can write about it. And they will never let go of that fandom because that's what motivated the involvement in the first place.
I think that's true. I think that's also, you know, I don't necessarily want to read what that person or listen to what that person has to say, because it's not coming from, I think that dispassion, you can be passionate and dispassionate at the same time. And I think that's something that people lose, and because they're not opposites, or they are, but I'm also still thinking about that guy. And, like, obviously you can't forgive white supremacists. They're white supremacists. I'm in no way standing with that dude.
I hate to tell you, but he wouldn't stand with you, Jesse.
No, he absolutely wouldn't. I'm just thinking about how, like, and because this is going back to, like, what I was saying before about myself, you know, how much of and taking it to sports, how much of what you see now from, especially because as people try to break into the sports media business, are doing so as, you know, right out of college and doing it through social media where it is not coming off well. And I think about, like, if Twitter and social media had existed you know, when I was in college and in my early 20s, I would have been even more embarrassing than I am now on there. And I'm pretty embarrassing now, like the stuff that I put on Twitter. So it was that part. It was, you know, the part of that guy being 21 or 22, and he's just, you know, taking a tiki torch to his whole existence. White supremacy, different from being a huge fan of the Milwaukee Brewers, who really has terrible things to say about the Chicago Cubs. That is obviously an entirely different universe. Let's be very clear on that. But it's the same idea of, like, idiocy of your youth is now something that can carry over into your later years in a way that it previously you could shake it a lot easier. And, like, even just a few years ago, you could shake a lot easier having been a dumbass 22-year-old, because there's a lot of dumbass 22-year-olds, pretty much all of them.
Yes.
I certainly was.
Ditto, ditto. You know, it's funny that you come at it from the point of view of destroying yourself. I was thinking that if social media had existed when I was a baseball fan, never mind a professional, I don't think I ever would have gotten as far as I did, because the shaming would have gotten to be too much. Because say it was around when I was 14 and I would have said, Ricky Henderson is a much better player than Don Mattingly. I don't care that Don Mattingly drove in 145 runs. Ricky scored 145. There's a relationship there that you have to acknowledge, and it's called Ricky's 400 on base percentage. And I would have gotten 100 million negative mentions and people calling me an idiot. And I would have said, you know what? I want to grow up and go to school and become a librarian and never talk to anyone again. The fact that I was able to put opinions out there, and sure, I got negative feedback, but wasn't avalanched back before these kinds of services existed, was a huge, huge benefit.
Yeah. You have to have room to fail in order to grow from it. And I don't know that that room exists now. I think that now you just, like, you're going to fail, but boy, help you, that you want to be able to do so in a way that not the entire world sees. And I think that's harder than ever. And, like, certainly see people younger than I am getting into it, and bless them, because they're, you know, they've got a tough road. And I don't really know how anybody does that now. And because you're going to F up. You just are. Everybody does. I don't know the answer. Because sometimes people will ask for advice, like, you know, what do I do to get in? And I'm like, I don't know if you want to, but kind of.
Don't. Unless you have to.
Yeah. It's brutal. I don't know. I'm secure enough in my own skin now to, like, deal with, you know, if I screw up or I have a failing, that, like, I can deal with it and, you know, move on from it. But, like, you do something stupid as a kid now, I don't know how you bounce back.
I'm going to take that thought. I'm going to put it in quotation marks. You have to fail in order to grow, Jesse Spector. And I'm going to put it on one of those dangling kitten posters. And we're going to have that. That's going to be the new meme. You're going to see it in offices and, again, schoolrooms, libraries, doctor's offices. You have to fail in order to grow, Jesse. Thank you very much for dropping by. Once again, we will make it so it is not an eternity. I mean, it's been 2.5 months, and that seems like forever. At the same time, from when we last talked till now, as we covered, not only has nothing happened in baseball, but to be honest, there are relatives I don't talk to for 2.5 months. So,
and really, this has been uplifting and inspirational from start to finish.
Thanks again, Jesse.
Thank you.
By Hercules, Unfortunately Aromatic Truss, we have made it to the end of another episode. If you want to follow Jesse on Twitter, he can be found at Jesse Spector. Seriously, you can't miss it. And you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because gourmet Stephen Goldman is an outright impossibility given the dominance of unholy bad food chains in the suburbs. We have a sponsor now, but nevertheless, this episode is brought to you by the number 31. Our producer is Gemma LeGluck. Our theme song, which you have been hearing throughout the episode and, in fact, are listening to now, is called The Infinite Man and was co-written by myself and Dr. Rick Mooring. Did I ever tell you about the time that Rick ran face first into a gigantic flowering bush? There's really not much more to tell than that, but trust me, it was hilarious. Well, if the dish soap doesn't have an illicit affair with the hand sanitizer and give rise to a colony of super intelligent bacteria named George, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the infinite inning.